Hello and welcome to a special two-part Lord of the Rings series of keynotes. The goal of this series is to examine Bear McCreary's music in the Rings of Power television show and compare it to Howard Shore's score for the Lord of the Rings movies. In the first episode, we discussed Bear McCreary's plan to keep the show's music compatible with the template laid down by Howard Shore's movie scores, despite not having the rights to use Shore's themes. McCreary's motto was, continuity, not quotation. We also discussed the importance of music for Tolkien as a writer, his love of poetry and meter, and his inclusion of songs and poems in his texts. We explored the origins of the cosmos in which The Lord of the Rings takes place, a creation story where music brings the world into being, and musical dissonance represents conflict. Then we discuss the music of the world of Middle-earth and themes that represent Middle-earth's history, the dangerous powers of the One Ring, and some of the races and their representatives in Middle-earth, including Galadriel and Elrond of the Elves of Lothlorien and Rivendell, Prince Durin and the Dwarves of Khazad-dûm, both before and after it became Moria, and the Hobbits of the Shire and their ancestors, the Wandering Harfoots, including Nori Brandyfoot. In part two, we'll move away from the more fantastical races and focus on the human cultures of the Second and Third Ages, Numenor, its successor kingdom of Gondor, and their heroic figures. Then, the more humble human peoples of Middle-earth in the movies and show, and complicated romances between elves and men. We'll discuss villains, the Dark Lord Sauron and his various evil servants. And finally, we'll examine and speculate about mysterious figures introduced in the show. A note up front that musicologist Doug Adams literally wrote the book on Howard Shore's score for The Lord of the Rings. His text is called The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films, and I highly recommend it. Much of this episode's detail on Shore's music comes from Doug's book, as well as some other important sources I'll list at the end as usual. At the point of this recording, only the seventh episode of The Rings of Power has aired. Therefore, it's possible that some of this examination will prove incorrect or outdated. But it's my confidence that most of it will remain accurate and relevant, and I'd like to do a follow-up or wrap-up once the season's ended. This episode will have spoilers for every aired episode of The Rings of Power, as well as the entire Lord of the Rings film trilogy. It will also contain some spoilers from The Silmarillion and the appendices of The Return of the King, both featuring material that influenced the show and the movies. In The Lord of the Rings, the race of men is in decline, physically as it relates to their civilization and their rule, but more importantly, they're in decline spiritually. All of their realms seem to be afflicted with an intense melancholy over lost greatness, which Shore manages to capture in the score. There were two great kingdoms of men in Middle-earth established by Elendil and his family, Arnor and Gondor. At the time of The Lord of the Rings, only the southern kingdom of Gondor remains, but is a mere shadow of its former self, languishing under poor governance. As the son of the Steward, Boromir of Gondor represents the kingdom at the Council of Elrond and joins the Fellowship on the quest to destroy the Ring. Gondor is only hinted at during the first two films in glimpses, discussion, and in the musical score. At the council, the ranger known as Strider reveals himself to be a descendant of Elendil and Isildur, two figures we're now very familiar with thanks to the TV show, and thus he's the true heir to the realm of men on Middle-earth, part of a line of kings which was believed to have ended a long time ago. When Gondor is addressed during the council, the realm's theme is stated by a lone French horn as noble yet weakened. by the return of the king, as Gondor moves closer to finally receiving its heir and restoring itself to its former glory, Howard Shore unfurls what he calls the Roman Empire orchestration of Gondor's theme. And as Gandalf and Pippin ride to Minas Tirith, the Tower of the Guard, we get a peek at what once was the height of Gondor. Even greater than Gondor was its ancestral civilization, the Kingdom of Numenor, established on an island gifted by the Valar themselves to the men of Middle-earth, who helped them to defeat Morgoth in the First Age. Elrond's brother, Elros, also half-elven but having chosen to be counted among men, became Numenor's first king, and their realm grew to rival even the most marvelous back on the continent. McCreary's theme for the isolationist island kingdom is full of this might and grandeur, and given Middle Eastern and Mediterranean inflections to make it distinct from Middle Earth. The composer has detailed that the lead melody for Numenor is performed on an Armenian double reed flute called a duduk, played in concert with a timbre, a kind of Turkish lute. McCreary previously used the timbre on 10 Cloverfield Lane. The duduk can be heard in many other scores, Munich, The Crow, Avatar, Syriana, and McCreary also employed it in Battlestar Galactica and some of his other works. It's particularly liked by Hans Zimmer, who used it in Gladiator, Pirates of the Caribbean, and his recent score for Dune. Ramin Djawadi used the duduk from the very start of Game of Thrones, associating the instrument with Daenerys Targaryen, the Dothraki, and much of her time spent on the continent of Essos. Other scores it's used include The Last Temptation of Christ and the shows Rome and Spartacus. It's an ancient instrument originating more than 1,000 years ago, and its application in movie music, if not to directly ethnically tie it to the Middle East, is often to broadly suggest antiquity. The duduk steeps Numenor in rich history and accomplishment, but when intoning the specific melody composed by Bear McCreary, it perhaps even gives a sense of slithering arrogance to the realm. Other governmental figures in Numenor, like the Queen Regent Miriel and the Chancellor Pharazôn, share their kingdom's theme, acting as representatives and extensions of it. If you've seen the Lord of the Rings movies, you'll know from the very first minutes, the prologue, that at the end of the Second Age, the One Ring is cut from Sauron's finger by the Numenorian Isildur following the death of his father Elendil, and that having been seduced by it, Isildur neglects to destroy the ring. He claims it for himself, eventually resulting in his death. In Tolkien's writing, Isildur is a much more complex figure. Where the movies needed to tell an abridged version of his tragic story, the show has an opportunity to explore Isildur and his family with more nuance. The Rings of Power situates the family as a minor noble house with the patriarch Elendil as a captain of Numenor's naval force, the Sea Guard. Elendil and Isildur are given a noble and, importantly, much more humble theme than their nation. Though the realm is much indebted to the elves and the Valar, over the centuries, Numenor has developed a political climate that's increasingly dismissive and even hostile to the elves. The most recent king, Tar Palantir, has been forced into exile for his loyalty to the elves, and his daughter, Miriel, ruling as regent queen, seems to be publicly distancing herself from the association, if not keeping the faith behind closed doors. Elendil and some of his family seem to carry this veneration for the elves, but are treading carefully for political reasons. Elendil's daughter, Isildur's sister, Eärien, a creation of the show, appears to be following the popular anti-elf sentiment. Nonetheless, she shares her father and brother's theme, and for her, it's usually performed on what sounds like a recorder. Those who, like Elendil, support the elves will become an increasingly oppressed minority known as the Faithful. Bear McCreary has already openly said that we'll come to discover that the theme for Elendil and Isildur will be the leitmotif for the Faithful. And as Elendil and his family rise to be the figures of legends that we'll know them to be by the time of the Lord of the Rings, surely we'll see this musical theme soar to profound heights. It's mostly the faithful who will survive the fall of Numenor and, under Elendil and his sons, will establish Gondor and Arnor, the great kingdoms of men in exile on Middle-earth. But as we know, these civilizations will begin to decline as well. The reclamation of the broken Gondor in The Lord of the Rings is mirrored by the rise of Aragorn, who begins as a mysterious, rugged ranger known as Strider. When the hobbits observe Strider taking an interest in them at the Prancing Pony, he's given a dark, uncertain motif. But a more heroic theme later emerges as Aragorn advances further along his journey to the throne. Aragorn is in love with the elf Arwen, daughter to Elrond. Their relationship is deeply complicated as he's a mortal man and she's an immortal elf. Therefore, their female soprano-led theme, Evenstar, is beautiful but delicate, mournful, a bit tragic. The relationship of Aragorn and Arwen Evenstar is a recapitulation of a story very precious to Tolkien, the tale of Beren and Lúthien from the First Age. Their relationship was likewise star-crossed, an enchanting but tragic love between man and elf involving the theft of a Silmaril from the very crown of Morgoth. During the Fellowship of the Ring, Aragorn sings to himself the story The Lay of Lúthien while he makes camp with the hobbits. The Rings of Power show introduces another Beren and Lúthien, or Aragorn and Arwen-inspired dynamic, with the Southland human Bronwyn and the Sylvan elf Arondir. Their musical identity is shared, which is to say that Bronwyn and Arondir do not have individual themes, but one that represents them as individuals and as a duo. The theme is romantic, naturally, but unlike Arwen and Aragorn's relationship, at the beginning of the season, theirs is unconsummated, and so they're given a beautiful sense of yearning. McCreary has named John Williams among his influences on the score. We've already talked about an earlier theme that was reminiscent of Williams' motif for the Ark of the Covenant. Bronwyn and Arondir's theme in particular reminds me of Williams' romantic material, especially his music for Anakin Skywalker and Padme in Star Wars, another star-crossed lovers storyline. We've already heard the Evenstar love material from the Lord of the Rings movies, the music for Aragorn and Arwen. The Rings of Power show nods at this particular vocal palette in Bronwyn and Arondir's storyline as they and others prepare to weather an attack from the orc army. The first real organized province of men we're introduced to in the Lord of the Rings films is that of Rohan in the Two Towers. The king, Theoden, has been corrupted by the wizard Saruman, and his family, subjects, and realm are suffering. When the theme is introduced in full for the first time, there could be no better cinematic imagery than that which accompanies it. A flag of Rohan in the capital of Edoras, torn off its pole at the Golden Hall, drifting down a hill in the wind and, witnessed by Aragorn, landing on the ground outside the gates. The music for the Rohirrim is Nordic-influenced, and the Golden Hall is no doubt in part inspired by Tolkien's beloved myth, Beowulf. Shore renders Rohan's theme memorably on a Hardanger fiddle, meant to give a rustic touch to the Horse Lords. Like Moria, Rohan is something of a diminished place when the main characters come upon it. There's a greatness there, somewhere, which has been lost. However, unlike Moria, but instead like Gondor, we'll get to see the realm restore itself. And so as the king's strength returns, so does the anthem of the Rohirrim. Just as the Rohirrim are an earthier, less lofty kingdom of men than Gondor in The Lord of the Rings, the low men of the Southlands in the show are presented as a much more primitive human civilization than that of Numenor. The Southlands, however, have a much less honorable history than Rohan, for during the Wars of the First Age, their ancestors served the wicked Morgoth. They struggle with that legacy, and because of it, they're deeply mistrusted by the ever-remembering elves. And to make matters more fraught, the Southlands region, though currently covered in trees and greenery, is home to the volcano Aradruin, which will erupt, becoming Mount Doom and reshaping the land into the desolate Mordor, the future domain of Sauron. The music of the Southlands is less advanced than Numenor, and rather medieval. As Howard Shore did with Rohan, Bear McCreary shades the Southlanders with Nordic influences, some developed from his experiences on the God of War video games. The composer employs hammered dulcimer and the Swedish nickel harpa. But to further cement the comparison with the Rohirrim, McCreary specifically returns the Hardanger fiddle to the fold. The theme evokes a sense of dourness, of perseverance, perhaps of potential, for glorious acts or for terrible ones. In a way, some of it recalls Ramin Djawadi's theme for House Stark in Game of Thrones. It's downtrodden, pessimistic, and resigned to expect the worst. At this point in the TV show, the Southlanders are awaiting the return of their lost king, who is apparently a refugee named Halbrand, and who therefore shares the music theme of his people. Having become Galadriel's associate in Numenor due to a chance meeting, Halbrand is poised at the moment to be an Aragorn analog, only darker. A grungy and underestimated man, seemingly of low stock or birth, and as in the films of royal inheritance, but full of burden and doubt. Still, there's much speculation about his nature. One of the show's great mysteries and teases is the identity of Sauron. Tolkien developed the villain to be a shapeshifter, a magical ability of most relevance during this Second Age period, as Sauron, assuming the identity of Annatar, meaning Lord of Gifts, secretly takes a fair guise in order to manipulate the peoples of Middle-earth and Numenor. Many have speculated that Halbrand, rugged yes, but very handsome, with an affinity for blacksmithing and a tendency to charm and exploit, is in fact Sauron himself. A few have suggested that Sauron and Halbrand's themes bear similarities, though I'm not sure I agree. It's true that their first passages both have five notes, but they're melodically very different. It's possible that McCreary could twist or develop the theme of Halbrand so that it might unmask itself to be Sauron's theme, so to speak. But because Halbrand shares it with his people, I believe it's much more likely that any similarity is meant to act as a dramatic device. It's an outstanding question as to whether or not the Southlanders will go the way of their ancestors and support Sauron, or stand against him. And at this point in the show, this is already an explicit divide. In the Lord of the Rings films, Sauron and the Land of Mordor, which holds his dark servants and fortress of Barad-dûr, are represented by an array of figures and sub-themes. But their primary theme is a hellish, violent figure which erupts from a raita, a Moroccan double-reed woodwind instrument. This theme is often employed to underline the relentlessness and fierce scale of Sauron's threat. And as Sauron exists in the Lord of the Rings as a disembodied, ever-gazing eye, the music helps to corporealize him, to manifest him and his dark servants into a unified being. The Rings of Power, Bear McCreary develops a unique theme for Sauron that also manages to capture the frightening evil and infernal power of his presence and represents his evil legacy. This unpredictable, unnaturally twisting melody is supported by deep, powerful chanting in the Black Speech of Mordor. As with McCreary's other themes, it's motivated by a rhythm that sometimes stands in for the leitmotif by itself. An aggressive bowed string ostinato set in an unsettling 7/8, opposite an opposing meter for the vocal line. Black speech is intentionally meant to sound unpleasant to the ears. It's rarely musically used in the films, but one of its few choral appearances occurs when Saruman the White reveals himself to be in league with Sauron and betrays Gandalf, sending him to the top of the Tower of Orthanc as a prisoner. In the first two of the three films, the wizard Saruman is perhaps the most powerful servant of Sauron, though his alliance is one of opportunity, and he has designs to usurp his master. Saruman has improved upon the orcs of Mordor, breeding larger and more ferocious warriors which, unlike Sauron's orcs, have the ability to freely move in daylight. The corruption of nature by way of industrialization is a primary theme in Tolkien, one symbolized by Saruman's war machine. To illustrate this musically, Howard Shore's theme for Saruman, for the wizards Uruk-hai and for the machinery of Isengard, features a blunt, six-note descending motif for low brass. However, its most prominent element is an incessant 5-beat rhythmic pattern made up of metallic pounding, evocative of the unyielding persistence of industry. It's metered in 5/4, an uneven time signature that pushes against our natural impulse. In the Rings of Power, a being who is called Adar, a Sindarin name meaning father, is commanding the orcs in the Southlands. In episode 6, he's revealed to be one of the first orcs, or in the Black Tun, Uruks, as he prefers to be called. An ancient elf twisted and corrupted, and therefore an ancestor or father figure to the other Uruks. After following Sauron, Adar claims to have killed his master because too many of his Uruk children were suffering, and it seems he's taken over at the moment as an apparent successor. Just as Saruman had wished to do, Adar usurped Sauron, or at least he believes he has. But what's different between Saruman and Adar is their sense of duty and their compassion. While Saruman seeks the ring to solely maximize his own strength, Adar's scheme seems to be rooted in a genuine desire to create a home for his people, for the Uruks. And while Saruman breeds his Uruk-hai-like animals to be used as cannon fodder, Adar seems to be venerated by the orcs, who name him father. He's introduced attending to a mortally wounded orc, and sorrowfully puts it out of its misery. Adar's theme is often anchored by a ritualistic march chant from the mouths of the orcs who serve and respect him, a chant emphasizing the black tongue word Nampat, meaning death. Bear McCreary's 11-note melody for Adar seems to also feature black speech vocals, but it's much more rudimentary and forthright than Sauron's winding 23-note line, perhaps implying he's small potatoes compared to the real Dark Lord. Adar might have big plans, but the game Sauron is playing is much longer and much more complicated. More evocative, Mono Verontist on YouTube and Twitter has pointed out that Adar's theme is the opening notes of Sauron's theme played in reverse. By the Lord of the Rings, Sauron's ringwraiths, the Nazgul, are both his most terrible servants and the greatest testament to his evil skill. The wraiths were 9 men who received the rings of power from Sauron and were corrupted by them, becoming wealthy and glorious kings, sorcerers, or warriors. However, through the magic rings, they were ensnared into being Sauron's servants. And the immortality granted to them sort of depleted their life's essence until they were thinned out into invisible wraiths. Howard Shore's theme for the Nazgul gathers all of the notes from the theme he wrote for the Ring's Seduction and stacks them on top of each other as powerfully chanted chords, bellowed with the hateful zeal of a black mass. The exact makeup of the Nazgul is ambiguous. In Unfinished Tales, Tolkien names one of them as an Easterling called Camul, and in the Silmarillion, 3 of the Ringwraiths were said to be Numenoreans, which may be important for the TV show. The chanted language in the score is Adunaic, the language of the men of Numenor, a reminder that Sauron helped to corrupt the greatest realm of men. And in the lyrics, the Nazgul proudly identify themselves as the Nine, the Lords of Unending Death, declaring their loyalty to the darkness and its power and glory. The chief of the Ringwraiths is the Witch King of Angmar. Before the events of The Lord of the Rings, but after the events of the Rings of Power, on behalf of Sauron, the Witch King was responsible for laying waste to what was left of Arnor, the northern kingdom on Middle-earth established by Elendil. Later, as you'll recall from the movies, the Witch King impales Frodo Baggins with a Morgul knife on the ruined watchtower of Weathertop. The Witch King's identity is unknown. Might he be Halbrand? Adar? Or another character introduced in the TV show. Another mysterious figure introduced in the show is aptly called the Stranger, a term specific to the Harfoot folk to denote him as an outsider, but all the more meaningful for us. His musical theme is indeed cryptic, a beautiful waltz teetering back and forth between dangerous and benevolent. This long-haired, bearded man fell from the sky like a meteor. A confused amnesiac, he's fixated on a constellation pattern, and his confusion sometimes seems to cause harm to those around him. The crater form when he crash-landed ominously resembles or foreshadows the Eye of Sauron from The Lord of the Rings, and the flames from the crash don't produce warmth, a phenomenon earlier noted by Galadriel to occur at sites of great evil. Worst of all, he seems to be sought after by a very creepy-looking cult who bear the symbol of the constellation he's interested in. This cult is referred to as the Mystics on the soundtrack, which features some curious developments of the Stranger's theme. And the three members we've seen on screen are credited as the Dweller, the Nomad, and the Ascetic. The mysterious group's rhythmic, ritualistic Quenya whispering has been translated by Mano Verontis as Omniscient Allfather, Omnificent. The Quenya Allfather is Ilúvatar, the world's one god, so in other words, all-knowing god, creator of all things. What it means that this sinister-seeming cult appears to venerate Ilúvatar is an open question. But the chanting reminds me of Michael Abel's score from Jordan Peele's Get Out. Brother, or us. However, the most pervasive, and I think the most convincing theory, is that the stranger is a member of the Istari, a wizard, possibly one of Tolkien's little explored blue wizards, but most likely Gandalf. The stranger's state of confusion somewhat resembles Gandalf the White's memory loss when he's brought back to Middle-earth after dying in Moria, and Aragorn must remind him of his name. And in the show, the stranger's interaction with the Fireflies is clearly meant to resemble Gandalf's interaction in the films with the moth that summons the eagles. If this is true, Gandalf's special kinship with the hobbits may begin with Nori and the Harfoots in the show. While his music is often uneasy, there are moments when the stranger's theme blossoms into the kind of heroism that feels appropriate for Gandalf. Curiously, Howard Shore opted not to give Gandalf the Grey a theme in The Fellowship of the Ring. Shore wanted to keep Gandalf initially a little enigmatic, certainly not as darkly obscure as the stranger on the Rings of Power, but a figure apart from the other beings on Middle-earth. It's not until the second film, The Two Towers, that material develops for him as Gandalf the White. Shore's soaring theme for Gandalf the White is not just heroic, but luminous, manifesting virtuous divine power, and, most importantly to these tales, featuring the Rings of Power, it makes him feel incorruptible. That does it for the second episode of this two-part keynote series on The Lord of the Rings and The Rings of Power. However, my hope is to put a button on the series by returning with a briefer wrap-up episode after the show's season finale, when some of the music developments have become more clear. All of our episodes are written, produced, and narrated by Nick Nylund. Before I go, I want to list off some sources that were essential to this episode. Most books listed can be found on Amazon.com, and all podcasts are on iTunes. The key reference work is musicologist Doug Adams' book, The Music of the Lord of the Rings Films. It features extensive interview material with Howard Shore, in-depth analyses of all of the music and thematic material, and a scene-by-scene musical breakdown of all of the movies. The Fellowship of the Ring series from David W. Collins' podcast, The Soundtrack Show, which also references Adams' book and culminates in an interview with him. Various interviews with Bear McCreary, especially his long YouTube conversation with In Deep Geek. And the composer's own ongoing blog series, The Lord of the Rings Appendices, inspired by the special features on the film trilogy's home video releases. I'm thankful for the continuing insights on the show's music from scholar Frank Lehman, who, among other things, has been building an incredible catalog of musical themes from Star Wars, and for the analyses from Twitter user and YouTube channel Monoverantis. I'll include both of their handles and links in the show notes. Finally, the Tolkien Professor, scholar Corey Olson's many lectures, podcasts, and video discussions on all things Tolkien. He's the president of Signum University, and his prolific content can be found on Signum's YouTube channel and his Twitter account, @TolkienProf. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Please subscribe, rate, review, or just leave a comment on iTunes or your respective podcast platform. You can email us at keynotespodcast@gmail.com. You can find Keynotes on Twitter at one word at Keynotes Podcast. And you can find me on Twitter at Nick Nylan. And finally, to play us out, here's White Leaves from episode 4 of The Rings of Power by Bear McCreary. Thanks for listening.